Hello and welcome to Behind the Buyouts, the deals podcast where we speak to private equity and venture capital practitioners about their deals and deal making. I'm your guest host, Nikita Sathiraju, senior reporter at The Deal. We have with us today David Dubner, global head of M&A structuring and resident spinoff expert at Goldman Sachs. He's here to talk to us about the rise in corporate separations, take privates, and divestitures over the past couple of years and the state of M&A going into 2024. David, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Nikita.
So let's start with talking a little bit about your career before you got to your current role at GS.
Sure. So I started my career in public accounting. This is two lives ago. Then went into the practice of law. I was a tax lawyer at Cravath before coming over to Goldman. Joined Goldman in 2006 and have been focused on the M&A business that you were referencing in the outset since that time.
And when did you start your role as the global head of M&A structuring?
So I've always been engaged in what we call M&A structuring. It's had different names over the years. But when I came to banking, again in 2005, 2006, that was a period of time when many of the bulge bracket banks were building practices in what we call M&A structuring to help bring more creativity to the M&A process, right? To help our clients optimize value, whether they be on buy side or sell side, through deploying creative approaches to structuring a transaction.
And your current role, obviously, as I mentioned, is all about spinoffs, dealing with bulge bracket public companies. And there has been a rise in those kinds of deals over the past couple of years, whether that be spinoffs or strategic reviews, corporate carve-outs. What's behind that trend? What are the specific factors that have led to this uptick?
Sure. There's so many things, Nikita, we could talk about in response to that question. I think what the most profound change we have seen in the capital markets over the past few years has been the rise in interest rates, rising cost of capital. What that's led to is corporate boards and management teams reassessing effectively what they are the optimal owners of, right? What are the businesses as they think about their strategic priorities, their capital allocation priorities that they will continue to emphasize? Because unfortunately, capital is no longer free, and that leads to more difficult decisions as they think about portfolio composition. Similarly, when you look at the rise in the complexity of corporate portfolios, what we've seen is a rising number of segments, and this is on a global basis, but when you look at public company reporting, over the past 10 to 15 years, you've seen a rise in both the number of segments and the size of those segments, which increasingly leads companies to consider the question of when has portfolio diversification shifted into complication or complexity? And that's a key driver underlying many of the transactions that we're engaged in.
I think we have seen notable deals happen in 2023, Kellogg and J&J being some of them. I know you mentioned when we were talking earlier that they're more US focused, but globally too, there's been a lot happening. You look at the volumes over the past couple of years compared to this year, has it held steady, especially given how choppy public markets have been?
It very much has. And I think it reflects the type of transaction, a spinoff or a demerger as they're referred to in Europe, which is effectively counterparty agnostic, right? As you think about the divestiture of a subsidiary or an underlying business, unlike regular way M&A, where we need to identify buyers and sellers, spinoffs or demergers requires no counterparty. So in volatile markets like we currently live in, increasingly as there may be regulatory constraints on strategic's ability to acquire assets, or as private equity has been sidelined to some extent in recent years, we're seeing corporates turn more towards spinoffs as an actionable way to engage in a divestiture or exit of a non-core business. And that's increasingly a part of the practice. I would also add, Nikita, that spinoffs can be an important backstop to a regular way M&A process. Specifically, if I am otherwise contemplating a divestiture, I can engage in what we would call a dual or triple track process, where I'm engaging with strategics, with sponsors, but I also know that I had a limited execution risk opportunity to backstop those processes through the demerger or spinoff.
Right. And I think the other thing that I'm curious about is, just given the market we're living in and the volatility that we're going through, has there been anything different or new in the way these particular spinoffs or separations are being structured?
I go back to the point on creativity. We spend a lot of our time with our clients thinking about how do they optimize their capital structures? How do they achieve the right balance, debt remaining at the parent company, as well as debt on the spun off company? We think about proceeds. So we spend quite a bit of time asking whether or not we should engage in an IPO or other capital raising transaction, perhaps vis-a-vis a sponsor, infusion of capital, either in advance of a spinoff transaction, or increasingly, we're seeing retained stake spinoffs where corporate parent companies divest or spin off 80% of a business. They hold back 20, and that allows them, Nikitha, to therefore generate proceeds on the back end once the equity is largely distributed at that point in time.
I suppose I'd ask that question about the broader M&A market as well, just in general, because all the things that we've had to deal with, the things that just came up unexpectedly this year, what's different when you're looking at how deals are being structured in general, outside of just spinoffs, when you're maybe even looking at take privates or divestitures to another party?
You're right that the market has changed. There's a great deal of volatility, whether that be macro, right, interest rate, inflation, there's geopolitical tensions, which we're all aware of. And increasingly, the regulatory environment can delay or increase the risk between announcement and closing. As a result, in particular of that last point, we're spending a lot of time thinking about how we de-risk the M&A process between announcement and close. And so specifically, what are some of the key changes we saw in 23? We saw a shift from sponsor M&A to corporate M&A, and we've seen a shift from cash-based M&A to stock-based M&A. So as we see more corporate buyers deploying equity to a greater rate than they have in the past, we need to think what happens with that equity volatility between announcement and close. So we're increasingly spending time on creative structures designed to bridge value bid-ask spreads or value divergences, which can occur in that time period. A few things I'd point you to, Nikitha, are one, collars, right? So in a traditional M&A process, a buyer will provide a fixed number of shares to a seller, and the value of those shares float between announcement and the close. A collar can be a way for the buyer to have the seller share in some of that equity volatility or equity risk between announcement and close within a band. So if the buyer share price falls by X, perhaps the number of shares grosses up by Y. And similarly, if the buyer experiences an uptick in their share price, they may be able to benefit from that. So collars is one powerful tool that we think about. We also think about whether or not buyers can substitute a portion of the shares that they might otherwise issue with cash if their share price has risen. So can they go to the market, monetize shares at a higher price, and then de-risk the transaction by what we call a consideration mix shift in that process? And the last point I'll make is how we think about de-risking M&A post-closing. So if you are engaged in a transaction where you're issuing equity and you are the buyer, how do you ensure that that equity ends up in the right hands? How do you minimize the churn, right? The shareholder churn that would effectively occur post-closing? And we spend a lot of time thinking about elections, merger elections. How can we provide the selling shareholders with the ability to elect between stock and cash, designed in ways to ultimately cause those who want to own the stock to elect to receive it, and those who might otherwise be interested in exiting to receive cash?
That last bit is really interesting. And does this apply to like the largest shareholders with like sizable stakes, like institutional investors, or is that something that can be done at a retail investor level of public companies?
Well, it can be done at all of the above, right? Because those holders, your large institutions, may have charter restrictions. So it may be that they're monetizing a large cap company in the S&P 500, and they're not equipped to own small cap equity that might be being received in exchange, or vice versa. Similarly, on the retail side, it could be because of tax frictions or otherwise that a large individual shareholder would prefer to receive equity consideration as opposed to cash. So there can be important reasons, both for the buyer trying to ensure their shares end up in the right hands, as well as for the selling shareholders who are trying to manage different objectives through those election mechanics.
That's definitely really interesting. And one thing that obviously has been on everybody's mind since late last year are valuations and the valuation gaps that we've seen between buyers and sellers. Has that at all normalized now that we're ending 2023, going into 2024? Especially, I'd imagine this would apply to take privates and divestitures, but maybe also what companies' expectations are in the public markets. Has that shifted at all?
I think it has. And this is to your point, right? You're highlighting that as we look at M&A volumes in 2021, we're at roughly half of that for 2023. And the M&A business is a cyclical business. When we look at typical M&A cycles, you know, from peak to trough, we generally see two-year fall-offs in M&A volumes. That's where we sit here at the end of 2023, which to some extent, if history is a guide, gives us cautious optimism, right, as we think about the cycle ahead. But on your specific question, I do agree we have had a wider bid-ask spread, right, for the past 12 to 18 months as interest rates have been rising. And that can often lead to a difference between valuation expectations on the part of buyers and sellers. I think that's one obvious reason why M&A volumes have come off. I think there's some increasing optimism or confidence around the macro that perhaps rate hikes are done. Our own chief economist is predicting that we are in a higher for longer rate environment, but not one where rates will rise, rather where perhaps in the US at least in Q4 of 24, we may begin to see rates begin to fall. So if you believe that rates are at the peak and that ultimately we are in higher for longer, that may allow the reset, I think, Nikitha, that you're alluding to at the outset, a reset of expectations. That has a couple of consequences. One bright spot of M&A in 2023, aside from the spinoffs or simplification transactions you alluded to, has been take private activity. That's been a bright spot in M&A. And I think in part, as valuations have come down, it created attractive entry points for financial sponsors. And as in a rising rate environment, as corporate boards, management teams viewed their own valuation, the value of their plan in a higher rate environment, ultimately led to a more convergence around take private activity. Again, that's been a bright spot. I think as we look ahead, as the 2021 highs in the equity market are no longer in the rearview mirror, they're no longer in the 52-week backtest, that will increasingly encourage M&A dialogues, which have been robust on a go-forward basis.
Absolutely. I wanted to circle back to spinoffs for a minute and talk about maybe the sectors where more of these separations have happened over the past couple of years. Are there any specific reasons why some areas might see more of them happening compared to others?
Spinoffs make the most sense for diversified companies, companies that have multiple businesses or perhaps multiple geographies, where there is, as I was alluding to earlier, portfolio complexity. So increasingly, you have seen a disproportionate amount of spinoff activity in diversified industries, industrials being the best case example, the old industrial conglomerates, many of whom have engaged in simplification transactions. So industrials and healthcare, when I look over the past, interestingly, 10-year window, we recently put out a study looking over the past decade, we saw that industrials and healthcare were a key driver, I think close to 50% of separation activity. When we look more recently, 22 and 23, 30 separations in 22 announced, another 23 here in 2023. Those are actually beginning to be spread more evenly, not only industrials and healthcare, but also technology, media and telecoms, and increasingly natural resources. Natural resources is a space, as we look at activity levels in 2023, that has experienced, I'll call it a resurgence in activity. towards, you know, the old economy sectors, and in particular, natural resources as energy transition and energy technology take on greater significance in the composition of portfolios.
Absolutely. And TMT too, is it because they're diversified, or are there any other factors at play that push these companies to reevaluate their portfolios?
I think there's a broader reevaluation of how technology plays into a corporate portfolio. AI is clearly a relevant thematic, both in terms of how businesses operate, but importantly, how we think about the M&A market ahead. So there's been a lot of reevaluation across TMT around SaaS models, around fintech, and around technology across other regular way industries, which is driving activity.
So when I look at spin-offs or divestitures, I'm usually thinking maybe there's some level of underperformance in that asset that the company wants to separate out from the main portfolio. But I'm starting to understand that these can also be opportunistic transactions. So I guess I'm curious to know what the weightage is when it comes to these deals of how much is underperforming versus how much has to do with it being an opportunistic deal for their shareholders.
A great question, because you're right. A spinoff is not a one-size-fits-all transaction. As we think about these transactions, they're done either for strategic reasons, right? As you think about unlocking or providing opportunities for different parts of the portfolio. But similarly, they can be a way to manage risk. And I think, Nikitha, you may be in your question thinking about a variation of transactions where the business being separated, perhaps maybe lower growth, lower margin, allowing the parent company to therefore potentially re-rate, right? You know, and market itself as having a higher growth and or margin perspective. I think what I want to highlight is there are examples on either side, right? So often as we think with clients about these transactions, it may be that you are separating out a growthier business that could trade at a higher multiple with a dedicated management team and a dedicated capital allocation policy derived from having an independent currency. By the same token, it can be the alternative. I think as we think about these transactions, we're focused on blended shareholder value creation. That's the lens through which boards and management teams focus. How do we position both company to be the best versions of themselves? And importantly, catalyze transformation. That's a theme that you'll hear a lot in this space. How do we transform the remaining company from the new company, whether or not it has the higher or lower growth or higher or lower margin? Put that aside. So to go back ultimately to where you started, we think these transactions provide the opportunity for both sides to experience value uplift. And the data shows that in practice, because the data tells us when we look at these transactions over the past decade, on a blended basis, we see the remaining company and the new company outperform their respective indices by roughly 600 basis points.
When you talk about blended basis, could you just walk me through that again in terms of how you measure that?
Sure. So you have a parent company that is trading as a whole company. Interestingly, when we look over the broad swath of these transactions over the past decade, you'll tend to see that parent company experience an uptick, right? We generally see a roughly 1% uptick on an announcement of a spinoff transaction. Between announcement and close, you tend to see that parent company slightly underperform its peers, which can be explained by virtue of there's significant strategic exercise occurring inside that company. Some investors may choose to stay on the sidelines during the pendency of the transaction, which can last 12 plus months to close. Post-close, as we think about blended performance, we're looking at the combination of the former parent company and how it trades, both in terms of share price as well as dividends, relative to its respective peer index, plus the spun-off company and how it trades, plus dividends relative to that company's sector index. And when we put that together on a blended basis, you know, weighted for the size of the businesses being separated, it produces the outcome I was referencing, right? 600 basis points plus of upside measured over a two-year period post-close.
And the two-year period, just because that's usually the amount of time it takes for all the related parts of the transaction to be complete for the spun-off company, or is there other factors that come into play when you're looking at that two-year period?
We chose 2 years because typically there will be some degree of shared services or transition services that needs to exist because NewCo may not be fully stood up from the standpoint of every function. 2 years is typically the window during which those transition services agreements roll off. So therefore, we thought to look to 2 years because that is a unique period in time when the NewCo or the SpinCo has been stood up and largely has little to no dependency on the former parent company.
Got it. Yeah, that makes sense. Now that we're almost to the end of 23, going into 2024, I think I did read in one of your reports that a lot of CEOs are going to consider some form of a strategic review. So I'm curious to know what your expectations are. What is the volume going to be like for spinoffs and separations?
I expect the trend of corporate simplification is here to stay. I think post-COVID, this internal lens being very deliberate vis-a-vis your portfolio balanced against a higher cost of capital is here to stay. And therefore, I expect we'll continue to see on a global basis more separations be announced. I think there's some unique, though, added tailwinds for that activity. One is always been here, which is external pressures, right? That is investors, in particular, activist investors, who are increasingly looking to unlock some of the parts discounts, not only through operational changes and governance changes, but through M&A. And the number one activism campaign relating to M&A is portfolio. So that will continue to be a driver. The second is, as we think about the geopolitical backdrop, rising tensions in different areas, you'll hear terms of nearshoring or regionalization in lieu of globalization. I think that begs the question, are we going to see an increasing level of geographic decoupling where companies say we can operate differently, we can pursue growth differently if we separate regional businesses? So we have seen, for example, some companies relist from Europe to the US as a way to attract higher valuations. By the same token, I think you might see companies in other geographies think about separating out their US business or their China business, just to pick two examples, as a way to, as I mentioned earlier, create a strategic opportunity or to manage risk.
What have I missed out on asking you that you think would be interesting to discuss about spinoffs in general before I go into my last set of questions?
Well, I think, as I alluded to earlier, spinoffs have largely been a de-risked M&A execution path because there's no counterparty required, generally agnostic to capital market conditions because you're not placing shares per se, but they do require a capital allocation or division, I should say, of capital structures. And as we think about the institutional leveraged loan market beginning to function in a more orderly fashion on a go-forward basis, I think that that lends itself to more constructive separation transactions, certainly more constructive M&A environment, private equity environment. But as you think about spinoffs, you can also ask the question, is this a product for both investment grade issuers as well as high yield issuers? And the answer is yes, this applies equally for both. But high yield issuers potentially have this added question of, are there one-time costs as I think about breaking my capital structure and how significant are those? As the leverage loan market continues to function to a greater extent, as that cost of capital perhaps comes down for the high yield universe, I think that will be a further tailwind as we think about this type of activity in the high yield universe.
And has it always been like an equal set or somewhat similar amount of activity for high yield versus investment grade, or has that also maybe changed to some extent over the past couple of years?
It's a great question. Some might believe that a spinoff must be a mega cap or a large cap phenomenon, and I would suggest it's not, right? So we have seen many small and mid-cap companies, including quite recently, over the past recent months, engage in these transactions because the thematics are the same. how do I engage or enhance strategic clarity vis-a-vis my broader stakeholders? How do I ensure that I have enhanced management focus? And how do I tailor my capital allocation policies to benefit each business? Those thematics apply whether you're a $100 billion company or a $2 billion company. A difference in my point raising high yield earlier was some of the breakage, the cost of capital distinctions can be different between the $100 billion company and the $2 billion company. And that's where there may be some positive developments as the broader markets begin to stabilize.
Got it. Just talking about M&A in general, and not just the corporate spinoffs that we've been discussing so far, what are your expectations there going into 2024? We obviously touched upon rate hikes not being as aggressive as they were over the past couple of years. So will we see a better year in 24 compared to this year?
We are cautiously optimistic, Nikitha, that we will. Again, I'll reference where we were in 21. We've seen M&A volumes reduce in 22 and again in 23. Historically, the down cycles for M&A have lasted 2 years. So if history is a guide, 2024 should experience an uptick. But I do think stabilizing the macro, right? If rate hikes are concluded, and we believe they are, and we'll begin to see rate cuts, that will be helpful. If the leverage loan market, the institutional leverage loan market, continues to recover, that will be helpful for M&A. Corporate simplification trends will continue to remain robust. Importantly, sponsor M&A activity, which has materially fallen off over the last 12 to 18 months. Again, we see some positive tailwinds as the macro improves for that part, that significant part of the M&A market to increase and thereby increase volumes in 2024.
Sponsors coming back to the table, would that lead to maybe them being more active in these divestitures and take privates that we've not maybe seen as much of from their perspective over the past maybe year?
I think in private equity, much like we've been discussing creativity and in strategics, you've seen sponsors engage in creative monetizations, right? So minority stake sales or continuation funds as a way to generate proceeds and return capital to their limited partners. What I'm cautiously optimistic about is that we will see more regular way divestitures, right? There is substantial dry powder, as I know you've likely discussed with others on your program, significant amount of dry powder sitting in the private equity universe. As we see stabilization in the macro, the hope or the optimism is that they will begin to deploy that dry powder, both for sponsor M&A, for continued take private activity, but increasingly corporate carve-out activity, right? Strategics who may be engaged in simplification, and here's where I'll tie it all together, corporates who may be engaged in simplification, who may be using a spinoff or demerger as a backstop to M&A, where private equity has been on the sidelines, if private equity comes back in force, some of those processes may naturally shift to private equity exits and cash-based monetizations, which I think is a win-win for the broader markets and everyone involved.
Absolutely. I think one thing that I do have to ask you before I let you go is private credit, because that's something everybody wants to talk about. And it's had quite a big boom of late. Is that in any way material to spinoffs, or does that change anything about that world, or is it more for the leverage buyouts and sponsor M&A market that's a little bit different?
Well, I think it plays a role in all aspects of M&A. As I think about recent spinoffs, we have not accessed the private credit market in the context of spinoffs. And I think part is often we're not reaching very far or extending the capital stack. Not always true, but in most cases we're not, which lends itself therefore to, I'll call it, more bank and institutional financing as opposed to private credit. So I do think that market, which I agree has been robust, has been an important part of the capital markets, will continue, but it may be more in the context of what I'll call regular way M&A, as opposed to the corporate separations we've been discussing here.
Thanks so much for a great conversation, David.
Thanks, Nikitha. So glad to be here.
This is Nikitha Satyaraju, Senior Reporter for The Deal. Thanks for tuning in to Behind the Buyouts.